thank our sponsors for this episode of LBE. Grateful for Crossway, their partnership over many years. And in particular today, want to mention Johnny Gibson's book, O Come, Emmanuel, A Liturgy for Daily Worship from Advent to Epiphany. Johnny's a professor at Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia. He's also a friend, good preacher, scholar. David is his brother. Those Gibson brothers do a lot of good things. Johnny has come out with several of these volumes, one for in general, one Be Thou My Vision, one for Lent, and then for Advent, this one, O Come Emmanuel, you can get, it's a very nicely, handsomely bound set of, not really devotions, but really a liturgy for the season that gives you prayers and readings and scripture. So check it out, O Come, Emmanuel from Crossway. And then also Desiring God, as we are still in the month of October, want to mention the DG program this month celebrating the heroes of the Reformation, highlighting well-known figures and some lesser-known champions of the faith. It's a 31-day journey. You can read or listen to short, powerful biographies of men and women who defended the Bible and its truth. Over 100,000 people have subscribed to this journey in celebration of the Reformation during the month of October. Here we stand. You can visit desiringgod.org/stand. And while we are mentioning Desiring God and thinking about John Piper, I want to invite you to the Coram Deo Pastors Workshop. John will be the keynote speaker for that here at Christ Covenant, February 13, 2025, just a few months away. We are limiting the seats to keep it to a small-ish gathering, and there's just a few seats available, so check out corumdeo.org for the pastor's workshop. John will be speaking about preaching, and I will be speaking as well. Price increases soon, so check out corumdeo.org. Greetings and salutations. Welcome to Life and Books and Everything. I'm Kevin DeYoung, senior pastor at Christ Covenant Church in Matthews, North Carolina. And I'm joined by two returning guests. We have live coming at you from Oxford. I assume that's where you are at the moment. Andrew Atherstone. And then David Jones in the middle, if you're watching this, from Aberystwyth. I've been to Oxford several times, and I'm sad to say I've never been to Wales. I really should remedy that. So David teaches at the university there in Aberystwyth, a great hymn tune, among other things, and Andrew there at Wycliffe Hall in Oxford. We're going to talk about evangelical identity and what does it mean to be an evangelical, and I will just explain the launching off point for this discussion, but these two scholars, friends, have done a lot of work. There's this fine book that Rutledge did, Making Evangelical History, Faith, Scholarship, and the Evangelical Past, and they also are editing this Rutledge Studies in Evangelicalism, which I've had the privilege of also being a part of and having them as the general editors, and they were on a year or two ago to talk about their big book about fundamentalism. So they really do have a knowledge in this. So I'm just going to start. Andrew, how did you get interested in this whole topic of evangelical identity? And feel free to talk about any other things that you have coming down the pipe about this or other related historical matters.
Thank you. Well, lovely to be with you again. I, as a young Christian, was nurtured within the evangelical movement. So I'm a member of the Church of England. I'm a minister in the Church of England. And self-consciously within an evangelical stream within it. So this would be the tradition of people like John Stott, J.I. Packer. Going a bit further back, you might think of J.C. Ryle, Charles Simeon, George Whitfield, that sort of school. And so I've always been interested in questions of identity, self-identity. What do we mean when we talk about being part of that movement, which maybe goes on for two or three centuries? And I teach, as you say, at this little college in Oxford, and our strapline, we're a seminary, part of the University of Oxford, but our strapline is the Evangelical College in the heart of Oxford. And very often, therefore, people are asking us, well, what do you mean by this? If it's on the branding, if it's on the headed notepaper, what is evangelicalism? Who counts? Who's in? Who's not in? All of those sorts of questions. So it's a very live question for me ministerially and vocationally, but also therefore historically, trying to use the resources of the past to try and answer some of those questions.
And what about you, David? And is the situation different in Wales, or same kinds of issues and questions and answers?
I think it's different. The Encyclopedia Britannica used to say, didn't they, for Wales, see England, and which is not true at all. And Wales is similar, but different. I'm like Andrew, I'm kind of brought up in the evangelical tradition, but not an Anglican tradition. In Wales, the Anglican tradition is much smaller. So I was brought up in the sort of nonconformist Free Church tradition, very much under the influence and legacy of Martin Lloyd-Jones. I was brought up in his first church in South Wales, his days, of course. Uh-huh. So in a sense, all my kind of historical work then, writing on the history of evangelicalism is dealing with that legacy and, you know, nonconformist evangelicalism being so much a part of Wales and Welsh identity, as well as evangelicalism itself. So trying to understand that, I'm writing a book at the minute on evangelicalism in Wales since 1945. So trying to understand my evangelical tradition and how that relates to other evangelical traditions in Wales at the same time. So it's part of the story of British evangelicalism more widely, but also distinct in and of itself.
So let me ask a follow-up question before I get to this article. As you talk about England, you talk about Wales, you talk about British evangelicalism more broadly. American evangelicalism is similar, but of course different. And this article from Matthew Avery Sutton has in particular in mind unique political dynamics of evangelicalism in the United States. So we'll come back to that, but I would love to hear from one or both of you, and feel free to just be candid and honest. How does this whole discussion get shaped for good or ill by the American variety of evangelicalism? And how do Brits or how do the Welsh look at, do they say, oh, evangelicalism in America? Yeah, that's our tribe? Or is there a sense of, wow, we want to distance ourselves from whatever's going on there? Go ahead. I'm unoffendable.
I would say it was much more of the second.
Yeah.
Which is evangelicalism, but not of the American variety. And trying to get away from a kind of American-centric way of describing the movement.
And is that a recent just because of Trump, or it predates that?
Oh, it goes a long way back. So
yeah,
plenty of transatlantic connections, of course, for centuries, as people are going across in boats and then on jet planes across the Atlantic. And a massive influence of American evangelicals in Britain. I mean, you might think of someone like D.L. Moody and Sankey coming in the 1870s and 80s. And really stirring things up here. You might think of Billy Graham, of course, famously in the 40s and 50s and 60s, frequently coming over on missions. And the English evangelicals wanting to welcome and definitely wanting to learn and use those evangelists, but also trying to say, well, we're a bit different from this. So we'll put Billy Graham in our pulpit in Cambridge to the undergraduates in 1955, at the Cambridge, famous KICU mission, but always trying to say, well, these are Cambridge undergraduates. We're not farmers from Tennessee. Different sort of cultural ambience going on. So there's a bit of cultural one-upmanship, I think, happening. A bit of elitism in the English zone. Very much that hangs on a lot. England is not like America, but the same is true. England is not like Wales. So there's quite a bit of sort of English elitism still as part of our culture here.
Well, I'm glad you could say it so we didn't have to.
And I think us in Wales would be keener to say that we are not like England, and as well as not like America. You know, and in Wales, there's a big tradition of defining ourselves against the English. You know, Wales is a population of 3 million people. England's a population of, what, 50 million people, or something around that. So we've always been dominated by our larger, more populous neighbour next door. But from the outside looking in at the American instance at the moment, you know, it's a lot of fun seeing how evangelicals, especially American academics, get their head around Trump, and the way in which I suppose they try to academically to distance themselves from what the bulk of the evangelical movement tended to think politically at the present time. And we don't, in Wales at least, evangelicals don't have that kind of purchase. We are a very small minority who don't have the kind of political influence that you have in America, really.
So we'll come back to that. Let me just give a brief abstract here. So this article, and Matthew Avery Sutton is a very well-known, well-respected scholar in this field. He's in America. And he had an article come out earlier this year, redefining the history and historiography on American evangelicalism in the era of the religious right. And trying to be fair to his argument, I think the burden of this paper, and you can, you know, someone can go find it online. I didn't have to subscribe to anything to download the PDF, is that there's no through line from historical evangelicals to at least American evangelicals in the present. And this is one of his important historical claims that we'll want to talk about. He says that beginning in the late 1970s, this whole batch of evangelical historians, Noel Hatch, Marsden, Ballmer, Grant Wacker, Harry Stout, and others, decided to describe, because they themselves wanted to be distanced from the religious right, described an evangelical, quoting here, as someone who affirmed a specific set of abstract theological ideas, and the movement as centered on a set of general convictions and doctrines that transcended time and space. Evangelicalism was not, as they characterized it, defined by its practices, networks, or cultural affinities, and certainly not by evangelicals' commitments to ideas about race, gender, sexuality, or class. So he builds on this argument, making the case that they picked this new evangelical historiography, a set of principles, theological ideas, which sort of allowed you to go back in the past and pick the good guys, the good men and women, the people that you like, to say, oh, look, they believe the same things. And you could pick your heroes, and it was a convenient way to find a continuity with the past that he's arguing doesn't really exist. So bringing it to the present, and then I'll turn it over to you, he comes to his conclusion at the end. So how does he define evangelicalism? Here's what he says. Here it is. I argue that post-World War II evangelicalism is best defined as a white, patriarchal, nationalist religious movement made up of Christians who seek power to transform American culture through conservative-leaning politics and free market economics. Contemporary evangelicalism is the direct descendant of early 20th century fundamentalism, North and South. Both movements are distinct from antebellum forms of Christianity. There is no multi-century evangelical through line. It's toward the end of his piece. Well, much more we could say, and we don't want to make this whole episode just going through Sutton's article. But as a jumping off place, let's just start with that last line. Andrew, what do you make of the claim, and it's not new, but that there is no multi-century evangelical through line? What should we think of that, Andrew?
I mean, I like the article. I really warm to Professor Sutton's desire to challenge the consensus. And we definitely have a consensus, you know. So some of those major figures he's engaging with, Mark Knoll, David Bebbington, very significant scholars in our generation of evangelicalism. And he's trying to say, let's think outside the box, is there a new way of looking at it? So there's plenty in that that I warm to. I think at the end of the day, I'm not convinced by the argument, because there are plenty of people right across the world and down the centuries who've used that evangelical language of themselves, mm-hmm. who've chosen that name. So to suggest that before 1942, we shouldn't really use the evangelical language at all, I think is a what would you do with somebody like J.C. Ryle, who died in 1900 and is very frequently in his writings describing evangelicalism, speaking of the evangelical gospel, using that as a language for himself. We have to take it away from him. I certainly agree with the suggestion we shouldn't go around baptizing everything we see, especially if we warm to it theologically as, oh, it must be an evangelical movement. We can do that much too quickly. And I warm to the idea of trying to write a history of something like the evangelical revival without using the word evangelical. These are intriguing suggestions. But to say there's no through line, I mean, there must always be a through line. Every movement has forerunners. Nothing is born de novo.
That's right. And it obviously this piece is directed most immediately to an American context. You can hear that in the very end of his definition, evangelicalism, white, patriarchal, nationalist, religious movement devoted to free market economics. I can tell you here that in the age of Trump, evangelicals, a lot of them don't give a rip about free market economics anymore. I certainly disagree with where he lands, if for no other reason than, you know, I think of the famous Quentin Skinner, you know, seeing things their way. I don't know any evangelical, I suppose there's some exist, who would think of themselves white, patriarchal, nationalist, religious movement seeking power to transform America. No doubt that describes some people, but the you know, 2,000 people in my church, all of whom I think would raise their hand and say I'm an evangelical, I'm not sure that describes much or any of them. It's not to say that there isn't a benefit in what he's trying to do. So, David, how do you read? Let me just tweak the question slightly, because to say there's a through line to evangelicals might be different than saying, is there a through line to evangelicalism? So do you see that differently, this ism? How old is this ism?
Well, the classic statement, isn't it, Don, that defining evangelicals that we all sort of start with and jump off from is David Bevington's four characteristics. You know, the emphasis on the Bible, the cross, activism, and conversionism. And he raises a number of times in that article about that being so broad as to be to fit any Christian, pretty much. And I've got an element of sympathy with that. I think it always needs to be qualified, and each of those points need to be opened up and explained. But I think you can define evangelicalism in terms of its characteristic theological beliefs or spiritual emphases, but also in terms of a coherent movement that linked together certain people in certain places at different times. I know a lot of my work is on George Whitefield, for example. And I'm trying as best I can to edit his correspondence at the minute. 3,000 items of correspondence from mid-1730s to 1770. And that correspondence is a means by which he created a movement, bringing together people around himself as much as anything else. And he almost defined evangelicalism, to be an evangelical was somebody who looked to Whitefield and was connected to him in some way or other. I suppose that tells us something about evangelicals' tendency to look for charismatic figures and to coalesce around individuals, perhaps rather than churches and institutions like that, and the individualism that's at the heart of it. But you can also, you know, you can define evangelism in those terms, as well as defining it in terms of beliefs and theological attitudes as well.
One of the things that I certainly agree with on Sutton is he says evangelicalism is also a series of networks and institutions, and that's clearly the case. And, you know, in an American context, when controversies blow up in our sort of evangelical world, it's not so much because this person signed this statement of faith and this person did, but it's, oh, somebody at Wheaton said something, or someone at one of our, you know, at Christianity Today, something that's considered an institution in the movement. So oftentimes the sparks fly because, well, wait a minute, you're connected to something we consider or have considered part of the ism, and now, you know, people are disagreeing about what they say. So I think he's certainly right in that. I wonder, you know, Andrew, you talk about J.C. Ryle, and I think you're working or have completed a book on J.C. Ryle. Is that correct?
I've just written the, what is it called? Ryle on the Christian Life.
Yeah.
The Crossway Life series. So that's been enjoyable. I've spent the last 3 or 4 years reading as many of Ryle's tracts and sermons as I can get my hands on.
My friends at Crossway, really, they rave about that, what you've done there. Look forward for it to coming out. And so you mentioned he uses the word evangelical. I'm curious, David, I assume Whitfield is using the word evangelical all the time?
Not really, no.
Really?
No, hard push to find him using that term.
What does he use to distinguish, you know, the good guys from the bad guys?
He was reluctant to talk, you know, often Whitfield would talk in terms of a kind of pan-denominational attitude. He wouldn't want to be tied to any particular group or defined too much. He often talks about the new birth being the thing that unites people and nothing else. And although he kind of argued with Wesley over predestination and things like that, there was that tendency with Whitfield not to define things too sharply and to be this kind of magnanimous person who transcended all of those divisions, a mere Christian, not... So, you know, he would, although he was a loyal Anglican in many ways, he wouldn't overemphasize that. And in America, he would play that down quite significantly. So, you know, it's that idea that evangelism can be highly individualistic and can elevate an individual rather than a creed or an ecclesiastical structure or a denomination. And that's not always been the case. But for some evangelicals, that certainly is the case. And being pragmatic, you know, being adaptable in different places. And, you know, Whitfield, there's a famous quotation by a historian about Whitfield. In England, he could be an Anglican. In America, he was a dissenter. And he could act the two parts equally well. And I think that's kind of a little bit typical of evangelicals sometimes.
Yeah, it strikes me, David, as you talk, you're really hitting on, even today, the strengths and weaknesses, you know, of an evangelical. We think of someone who's, you know, earnest and heartfelt and wants a personal relationship, flexible, but at times pragmatic. And today, lots of people decry the celebrity pastor culture, and rightly so. But, I mean... Has there ever been a bigger celebrity in evangelicalism than Whitfield?
No, and I think Whitfield's the archetypal celebrity preacher, isn't he? And if you trace the beginnings of evangelicalism to Whitfield, or at least to the revivals, then he's kind of set the agenda and set the tone for much of what came afterwards. And a lot of people who looked back to earlier generations, Puritan generations, lots of nonconformists and dissenters in England when Whitfield emerges, are perplexed by him, really, and find the lack of theological definition to be problematic. And I think, for me, from a kind of more reformed tradition theologically, then that can sometimes be an equal frustration at the same time, you know. And whereas I look more to a Reformed kind of worldview than the evangelical one, maybe, or straddle the two at least.
Sorry, I mean, there's lots of interesting parallels between a Whitfield character and a Ryle character in how they're describing the sort of movement that they're part of, and the way in which they have this sort of evangelical clothing that they're trying to wear. So Ryle famously has a text called The Christian Leaders of the Last Century, which in cricketing terms is like his first 11 that he would want to send out onto the cricket pitch to bat. But some of those are Arminians from the 18th century. So he's very happy to speak highly in praise of John Wesley and of Fletcher as well. Not so keen on Toplady. Keen on Toplady's theology as a Calvinist, but not really so much on Toplady's personal interactions. And Ryle gets a lot of pushback from readers on this because they say, you're much too broad in your capacity of who you're willing to work with. This isn't evangelicalism, this is Ryleism, they say. Evangelicalism is Reformed, it's Calvinistic. We can't have these Wesleyans involved. And at the same time, he's trying to stretch the movement backwards as far as possible. So very strong on saying it wasn't born in the 18th century. Remember the Puritans of the 17th. Remember the Reformers of the 16th. It's really a 500-year movement rather than a 300-year movement.
He has his parallel book on the Reformers as well, doesn't he?
Indeed.
At the same time. Yeah.
So let me ask this same question in a little different way to you, Andrew. So I'm reading here from your fine book that you both edited, Making Evangelical History, published by Routledge. And there's a fine chapter in the back by Mark Knoll about Timothy Smith, George Marsden, David Bebbington. And then I think the next chapter is about Mark Knoll by somebody else. But he says, this is really fascinating. He says, in the Google Ingram viewer, evangelical shows up frequently from the 17th century to the present. The situation differs for evangelicalism, with only marginal appearance in the Ingram viewer for British books until the early 20th century, and with no meaningful frequency until about 1950. For American books, the word barely registers until about 1950. I have a friendly back and forth with Miles Smith. He's a professor at Hillsdale in Michigan, and Miles is a friend and a very good historian. We go back and forth because I think he would say evangelicals didn't exist and we should just refer to them as Protestants. And I would say, well, I evangelicals did, but you may have a point with evangelicalism, and even Knoll acknowledges that. So how do you think, as an ism, Andrew, that this really is just a 1940s, 1950s phenomenon?
The word evangelicalism goes back at least to the 1820s and begins as a term of abuse from those outside the movement of their opponents. Evangelicalism, it sounds very unspiritual. It sounds very formulaic. It's an ism. No one really wants to be part of an ism. Very lifeless sort of idea. But then it begins to catch on amongst the evangelicals themselves as they're looking for a sense of international connection and part of a global movement rather than just isolated congregations, and speaking of themselves as being part of this as an idea. Yes, I mean, I'd be very happy to abandon the idea of evangelicalism and talk about the multiplicity of evangelical life in different parts of the world. But you couldn't, there must be a way historically of showing interconnections, that no congregation is just a little evangelical island by itself. It is connected to others. So how are you going to describe this thing? Perhaps simply the evangelical movement would be a way of describing it, or the evangelical renewal. Again, a sense of down the centuries, across the world, down the generations, movement has a sense of life. By definition, ism has a sense of kind of scientific box ticking, and no one quite ever fits the box. Again, a movement can have lots of people around the edges. You can have a mainstream and sort of offshoots and flows. Ism, we tend to have, four ideas, six ideas to who's in and who's out. And that's where that's where it becomes very politically dangerous, because you as the historian begin to set the agenda of who's part of this movement and who isn't.
In England or Wales, is there any kind of movement to get rid of the term? Because there certainly is in the States, because it's become a political marker. Now, I'm one who says, hey, this is a Bible word. This is gospel word. That's what the word means, and it has a historical resonance. So I'll tilt against windmills to help to try to define what the word means and take it out of just being a political interest group. But there certainly are people who are saying, give up on the term. It's irredeemable. And not only from maybe the left, but also from people on the right who would say, well, I'm a conservative Protestant, but I don't know if I'm an evangelical. I want to be fair here. But I think another professor at Hillsdale, I think someone like Daryl Hart might say that. Look, the evangelicals were the new lights. They were the pro-revival people. And, you know, if you didn't think that was such a good thing, or on balance it was, you know, a net neutral, and you're with the old lights, then maybe you don't want the term evangelical and you prefer to call yourself a Protestant, a Reformed, maybe your particular denomination. How do people, Wales and England, think about the term, or are they just happy to stand in the slipstream of Packer and Stott and Dick Lucas and, I guess, Lloyd Jones, a little more complicated history?
I think to pick up on one point that Andrew was making previously, it's, you know, we as historians like to make order of the past, make sense of the past, and sometimes reduce a messy picture to simple ways in which to chop up the past, you know, and that, I guess that's always been something that historians have done. You know, we talk about periods and medieval period and early modern and modern, and those things are only helpful insofar as they go, aren't they? I think Andrew said the point about historians making the run-in, in a sense, in terms of the definitions and who's in and who's out and that kind of thing. But in Britain, in Wales, I'm not sure there are as many voices calling for evangelicalism as a term to be sort of jettisoned. I think there are plenty of people who would distance themselves from the sort of American Billy Graham-ish revivalist tradition for a more kind of reformed tradition. But in Wales and England, I'm sure we're all heavily influenced by those sort of American movements and American ideas, not just in terms of evangelicalism, but more broadly as well, isn't it? American cultural norms carry an enormous sway, really. So we're always kind of struggling with that to some extent.
Yeah, Andrew, how do you see it?
I think it's a mixed picture within the Church of England currently, the context that I'm in. So one of the things about America's role globally, religiously, is that if a brand becomes toxic in America, that toxicity spreads right across the planet. And so in Oxford, for example, we might be having conversations. And if you use the language of evangelicalism, someone is immediately thinking the sort of rhetorical ideas that you might get in the States. So there can be that sort of sense of needing to, if not jettison the word, certainly explain what you mean and what you don't mean if you do continue to use it. One of the difficulties, of course, is finding a better word. If we jettison that, well, you need some sort of way of being able to describe yourself to people. But also within my particular context at the moment, there are quite a lot of, I suppose, theologically left-leaning folk within, say, the Church of England, theologically progressive, as they term themselves, who would very much be holding on to the evangelical language. So again, in those sort of political debates and those theological debates, it's easy to say, well, you don't belong in the movement because of where you stand theologically. And so the left can say, no, very much, you know, we're still evangelicals. We're still in the tradition of a Stott, perhaps not of a Ryle, perhaps not of a Whitfield, but certainly of somebody like John Stott, who's seen as the great 20th century, urbane, engaging sort of evangelical character.
And we have that. You talked earlier about even class distinctions, or, you know, in the States, with certainly a certain group of people, if you style yourself as a British evangelical, well, that's a much more palatable thing, even in America. Oh, a British evangelical. And I have lots of books by all those people you mentioned, and Stott and Packer and all the rest. But there is a way in which evangelical, Sutton makes this case that evangelical has often been a term to mean a truer kind of Christianity. Now that has a, you know, a flavor that we're just being elitist about it. But here's how he puts it: Protestants who wanted to claim that their beliefs were truer, or that their faith was more real and active than those they viewed as their religious enemies, described themselves as evangelical. Protestants of many theological stripes invoke the term to signal authenticity. And there's a lot of truth to that. Doesn't mean it's always wrong, but I do think, and I wonder how you would see this historically, that Protestants have often described themselves evangelical, meaning we're something in distinction to someone else. So the first Lutherans weren't Lutherans, they were evangelicals, meaning they're not Roman Catholics. I grew up in a mixed denomination with a lot of left-leaning progressive. And so when we called ourselves evangelical, we meant not theologically liberal. But we talked, you know, a year or two ago, for people after World War II, they said evangelical to mean not fundamentalist. So they were distinguishing themselves for people to the right. Is Sutton true that, or right, that very often this has just been a term to mean we're a certain kind of Christian and not this kind of Christian? How do you see that, David?
I think that's always the case, isn't it? You always define yourself over against somebody else. But I think for a lot of evangelicals, the purity element has been, we are the ones who go back to the Bible always, and we go back to the foundations. We go back to the primitive faith and the apostolic faith, and we've rediscovered, you know, that element of rediscovery has always been part of kind of evangelical identity, isn't it? And whoever that is, in whatever period you're talking about, there's always that, whether it's, you know fundamentalists against liberals, or I've just been reading the new biography of Gresham Machen, and you know, charting his move from an engagement with more liberal ideas and higher critical ideas to his later, I don't like to call him a fundamentalist, but I suppose he does get called that, doesn't he, these days?
Right.
I'd call him a conservative evangelical, really. But but that
confessional Presbyterian,
defining himself really over against liberalism, particularly by the 1920s, and the institutional questions that are bound up with that, about Old Princeton and things as well. So there's always that, isn't it? Always that tension. You know, I'm an evangelical. I'm not one of those. I'm not like so and so.
And to be fair, theological liberals would do the same thing.
Absolutely.
Or progressives.
Yeah.
They have people they do not want to be associated with.
And every evangelical group or generation tries to make that continuity. We talked about the thoroughfare of evangelicalism, the past. Well, all different groups of evangelists tend to say, well, these are the people who are in who I think are the the people I emulate from the past, and whoever they happen to be. You take the Banner of Truth's view of kind of Reformed Christianity, and they have this continuity that goes back to a certain point. And sometimes it's a very odd mix of people who are kind of put together, from Whitfield in his Anglican robes on the cover of any Banner book.
Yeah, there's certain, the who gets to be in the Puritan, on the
Puritan tradition.
Yeah. What does it mean? Oh, go ahead. Well, I was supposed to say, what does it mean in your context for Wycliffe Hall to say we're the evangelical school?
It's a very live conversation for us at the moment. So should we be changing the motto? Especially because we're seeking to invite students from North America to come and study with us in Oxford. So we're not just marketing the college to Church of England evangelicals, but if you begin to market...
Make Oxford great again. There you go. Feel free to use it.
Thank you. there's also a sense in which it's deliberately left hanging. So mm-hmm. it's left as this big tent word that we try not to overdefine. So it gives you some strong hints about what seminary life might be like in terms of theological emphases and scripture and Christ and the cross and conversion and these sorts of things, but is not as close as having a particular doctrinal basis. So that anyone who's attracted to that movement would be able to come along and enjoy the ethos and the environment.
Quintessentially evangelical, isn't it? Typical of evangelicalism.
Big tent evangelicalism, yes. You know, someone like, again, Daryl Hart in his writing would push back quite strongly against.
Right.
There's also a tradition in the Church of England currently of a revival of focus upon describing yourself as an articles sort of evangelical in terms of the reformed basis of the church, which is written down in 39 doctrinal points, or a prayer book evangelical, again with that sort of Reformation tradition, liturgically and historically shaping your evangelicalism, so that evangelicalism isn't just this free floating make of it what you want sort of movement, but does have texts which kind of imbue it or describe it in some form.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I grew up in the Reformed Church in America, Dutch Reformed tradition, but more mainline. And so we, you know, conservatives like me often use evangelical. Now I'm in the Presbyterian Church in America, which is in the grand scheme of things, all very conservative, but there's always a spectrum there too. And I would say, you know, me and my friends tend to use the language of confessional Presbyterian or ordinary means of grace, which are saying, you know, we take the confession very seriously. We believe that ministry should focus on the word and the sacraments. So there's always, and somebody else might say, well, we're missional, which again is trying to say a different kind of lean. There's always these conversations of how to distinguish, and it doesn't have to be that we're just trying to pat ourselves on the back. There really are marks of distinction. I had to go back, and it would be a shame if I didn't mention John Witherspoon at least once in this conversation. In 1768, he published a collection of sermons, Practical Discourses on the Leading Truths of the Gospel, and I just was pulling up the advertisement for it, and it says, "There appears to me," so this is from Witherspoon, "the greater necessity, because the evangelical principles have for some time past been falling greatly into disrepute, which I take to be the true and the single reason why religion at present is very weak and in a languishing state." So here's Witherspoon using the language to distinguish evangelical principles, and you could probably guess what his sermons are. They're about sin, conversion, new birth, regeneration, you know, with a Calvinist bent to a justification by faith, atonement, the cross, the sort of things you would probably guess from the middle part of the 18th century. One of the most interesting chapters in this book you edited was on Erasmus Middleton's biography, Evangelica. Now, maybe neither of you wrote this, it was by Darren Schmidt, but maybe off the top of your head, you'll remember. Can you tell us about that? Because I found that very fascinating. I didn't know this thing existed, but here's a guy, Anglican clergyman at the end of the 18th century, trying to do this thing we're talking about. Here's a biography, and here are the 200 people that I call evangelicals. What was he trying to do, and who did he put into the camp?
Go for it, Andrew. Do you remember it?
I've read the chapter many times. Yeah, cool. It's a highlight of the book. I mean, one of the things that all the chapters in the book are trying to do is to show the way in which evangelical historians bring to their craft a number of theological assumptions before they get down to looking at the text. So everyone is shaping the story that you're telling, often by your your presuppositions. And very often the question for the movement is who is in and who is out? Who counts as not even just authentically a gospel person, or authentically a Christian? And this is one of the things that Middleton is trying to do, ransack history, if you like, and he has some unusual people that we wouldn't uh-huh. consider part of the evangelical movement since the 18th century, putting into his dictionary from previous centuries. Can you think of evangelicals in the 14th century? You know, who could we name, and why would we somehow consider them not to be evangelical? That's one of the live questions that he's wrestling with. Are they simply proto-evangelicals who existed within the early church or within Roman Catholicism, but were really evangelicals in disguise of an 18th century sort? Or was there such a thing, Middleton's getting us to ask, as a Roman Catholic evangelical, a medieval evangelical? Or is this just kind of a range of categories that blows apart as soon as you begin to have such a broad description? John Stott, it certainly in his early writings, simply described an evangelical as a New Testament Christian. Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to be a New Testament Christian, if you're trying to follow Jesus and the teaching of the apostles, you count as part of the movement. You don't have to be part of this Anglo stream of Whitfield or Wesley followers since the 1730s. And that really opens the category into a different sort of conversation, I suppose, a conversation right. that drives us back to the apostolic texts, back to the teaching of Jesus. Who counts at that level? Who are the apostolic Christians? And are those the same as the evangelical Christians?
I'm trying to think, Andrew, about Stott. You know, I don't recall him saying a lot about revival. Of course, Lloyd-Jones has a whole book, Revival is the Answer. I remember when I did my doctoral work, John Coffey, who both of you know, said one of the shorthand definitions really of evangelicalism in the 18th century are pro-revival Protestants. So was that one of the underlying differences between Stott and Lloyd-Jones? I know Lloyd-Jones certainly loved revival, and I'm just trying to think if Stott downplayed that aspect of evangelical identity. What, David, you know, well, both of you know this well. I'll start with you, David.
Yeah, I'm more familiar with the Lloyd-Jones side of it than the Stott one, really. You know, Lloyd-Jones's theology of revival was always tied to his exposition of the baptism and the sealing of the Spirit. And Stott famously,
one of the oddities, yeah.
famously uh-huh. writes that book criticizing that kind of theology of Spirit baptism, and always distanced himself from the charismatic movement as well, didn't he, Stott? The early kind of charismatics, whereas Lloyd-Jones was much more encouraging to a number of early charismatic figures, although you couldn't really call him in any way charismatic himself in that sense. But for Lloyd-Jones, revival, you know, he has the series of sermons he preaches in 59, but revival is everywhere with Lloyd-Jones. You know, there's barely a sermon where that isn't portrayed, isn't as the answer, the solution to everything. And it's not couched in terms of evangelism as such. It's always talked in terms of God's presence and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's not talking about revivalism at all, especially in the American conception of that, and would, you know, distance himself from Billy Graham and all kinds of others would champion that approach to things. Whereas, again, Stott was an early exponent of Graham, wasn't he, and worked with Graham and mm-hmm. on the Graham Crusades. And Lloyd-Jones famously wouldn't go near them in the 1950s. So there is a very distinct understanding of revival that Lloyd-Jones is working yeah. with, really. And the emphasis is there's barely a sermon that doesn't reference it.
Really, right. What about on the Stott side, Andrew?
Stott reads, I think, far less history than Lloyd-Jones does.
True. Oh, that's a good point. You know, yeah.
Lloyd-Jones is loving the 18th century and bringing it a lot into his teaching and his whole worldview. If there was a historian, if there was a person from the past that Stott loves and models himself upon, it's certainly Charles Simeon at Cambridge, where the emphasis is very much patient Bible teaching in the local congregation. So going back to the New Testament and just faithfully, carefully, precisely trying to teach those things week after week after week. And that's what Stott does for much of his ministry. So he, I think, would see revival in terms of individual conversions, the slow growth of congregations as God adds to their number. He's certainly happy to get involved in big platform evangelism, but mostly amongst student missions around the world, largely mm-hmm. speaking to undergraduates. And again, it's a sort of faithful, typically eight addresses over eight days in a row, a sequence of following through the gospel from the fall through to redemption, very carefully explained, rather than, is that a revivalism? It's a form of revivalism, mm-hmm. But it's a very Cambridge University, I suppose, brand right. of event of revivalism.
It's a posh revivalism.
I think with Lloyd Jones, what people overlook is the Welshness, and he is shaped by the kind of 18th century Welsh Calvinistic Methodist tradition, and combines that emphasis on preaching and the Holy Spirit that is characteristic of that period. You know, he exemplifies that, and preaching and the unction of the Spirit is everything to Lloyd Jones. And it comes from that tradition then.
Yeah, we can forget. I mean, you wouldn't, but in America can forget. They just know, oh, Lloyd Jones, London. Yeah. Well, yeah, he was Welsh, though.
Yeah.
And that was a huge imprint on him, obviously. Want to mention a couple more of our sponsors. We're grateful for Reformation Heritage Books. And we're highlighting their series, Puritan Treasures for Today. If you want to get into the Puritans, and you should, whether you're a pastor, church leader, new Christian, read the Puritans. And these volumes use updated language, helpful introductions, and they get you into classic works by John Owen, Jeremiah Burroughs, many, many more. Perhaps reading some of the old Puritans sounds a bit intimidating, or you just need a refresher, and you can use this series of books, Puritan Treasures for Today. Go to Reformation Heritage Books, that's heritagebooks.org/Puritan Treasures. If you use the coupon CLEARLY at the checkout, you receive 10% off your order. And also want to mention again, our friends at Westminster Theological Seminary, their 100% online biblical language certificate program. Really is a good program if you want to learn where you are right now, some biblical Greek and biblical Hebrew. You can begin to understand short passages in the original languages in as little as 6 sessions. So go to wts.edu/language. We have just about 5 or 10 minutes left. I just want to zoom out and maybe two final kind of macro questions about history and the state of evangelical historiography. So the first one, I'll come at this way. How do we, and I guess I'm giving the answer in the way I asked the question, but how do we get that balance between not doing hagiography, just these are, you know, saints who, you know, basically walked on water, or what I call hamartiography, which is just they're sinners. And I feel like some modern historiographies, if they don't like the person, just they can't think anything good to say of them. You know, I very much cut my teeth as a young Christian, especially in college, reading the two volumes, Ian Murray on Lloyd Jones and, you know, Dalimore on Whitfield. And I mean, just and I'm thankful for the history that really says these are heroes, unique men of God who are used in powerful ways. I think one of the things that both of you have done in your works and in these books you've edited, and you know, there's a separate volume on Lloyd Jones, is with a sympathetic eye to still say, well, they were human beings, and the historians have shaped a certain view of them. How do you guys approach this? And I imagine you've even had people who are, you know, might read this volume and say, wait a minute, Hudson Taylor was my lifelong hero. And now you point out kind of some idiosyncrasies, or Lloyd Jones is my mentor from the grave, and now you've ruined him for me. How do you think about how to be honest about the heroes from the past without just being so cynical that we can't have heroes?
I think that's always a tough balance to keep. You know, I echo your, I remember sitting on a beach in France at the age of 16 reading Dalimo. Maybe I should have just been in the sea fooling around or whatever, but you know, but that shaped me, and that was my way into where I am today. You know, was reading those Banner biographies and getting the taste for the sort of evangelical past through those. But I think as soon as you start to read more deeply, particularly in the source material, and that's always got to be key. You've got to go back to the sources and reconstruct your stories of these people from the primary sources that exist. But as soon as you know, in Wales, in many circles, Lloyd Jones is regarded as beyond reproach. And I've been criticized for even daring to say something remotely critical of Lloyd Jones. People would shun me for that, you know, despite being an enormous admirer of him. So, you know, there's always that goes on as well within evangelical circles. But when you write, you go where the sources take you, and whatever it says, you tell the truth, and so be it. Really, you are our priority as evangelicals writing about the history of evangelicalism is to the truth, isn't it? And the primary sources dictate that.
Yeah. Maybe this sounds a little pie in the sky, but I think of it, especially these people. You know, as a Christian, we'll see in heaven someday, and they know themselves better than they did on earth. I would hope that maybe they would say, you know what, as best as you could, I felt like you fairly tried to understand who I was.
And who of us could bear the scrutiny that we put some of these people under?
Yeah, right. You know, good thing none of us will have biographies written about us, although David Bebbington's wife wrote one of him, so I keep telling that to my wife when she's going to work on my biography. Andrew, how do you think of this this tightrope walk between heroes but honesty?
Well, real people have real weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And when I read ministerial accounts from the Middle Ages of the quintessential hagiography, where they literally were walking on water, I think, how do I relate to this as a Christian disciple and as a Christian minister? It seems so out of my experience. That's a form of hero, I suppose. But when you're able to say, even of the person who had a God-blessed ministry, which was growing churches and seeing many converted and many, many taught and discipled, yet there were vulnerabilities, yet there were weaknesses, yet there were personal struggles, and those are written in the sources, and therefore they need to come out in any sort of fair appreciation of them. Actually, I can connect much better to that person because, you know, I'm vulnerable and struggling and weak in discipleship and ministry. So rather than a plaster cast saint, actually a full orbed picture, I think is often much more helpful to the Christian, rather than an unattainable life that is sort of impossible to the rest of us.
There's only ever one hero, and everybody else is a pale reflection.
That's right. And Jesus walked on water because our response is to worship him, and not to worship these heroes as much as we're right in a Hebrews 11 sense to have them. So my final question, just big picture. It seems to me that, so we're fully into the next generation of now Marsden and Knowles, these people have still doing work, but into many of their students or into the next generation of his historiography. And it seems to me like there's some necessary correction, tweaking, as always happens from one generation to another. That's part of intellectual inquiry. And yet maybe an overreaction in some places where these people who used to be looked at as, you know, somewhat as heroes, now are just understood as power-grabbing, white, patriarchalist, or maybe that's just how it strikes me here in an American context. What do you see as this the current state of the guild among evangelical historians? You encouraged, discouraged?
Go on, David.
I think there's some very good reasons to be encouraged in terms of the number of younger scholars attracted to the field, wanting to do good quality archival contextual research, carefully written histories, the number of PhDs that are coming through. I think that's a great encouragement. I think the other thing that is very encouraging is the pushing of the analysis beyond the Anglo world that we've mostly been talking about and most of the histories have been about over the last 50 years. So the number of new studies that are coming up from the Global South, often written by historians in those sorts of contexts, the way in which Pentecostalism and charismatic renewal is beginning to shape the evangelical movement globally, lots and lots of brand new and interesting fields in languages other than English. And those are great signs of a discipline going forward into new pastures.
It's one of the best things we do, isn't it? In a way, Andrew, is the Routledge series, where we can encourage those who've just completed PhDs into the first book, and you know it keeps us, you know, gives us a role then in encouraging new research and new insights into different. And we see the kind of work that's being produced really as proposals come across our desks and things. So it's a really exciting element, I think, of what we do. And a way that we can kind of take the discipline forward, really, as well.
So very last question. You just have 30 seconds. You're riding in an elevator, and someone, lo and behold, takes out this book and says, "Did you edit this book? I've been reading it at the beach, Making Evangelical History. Are you a scholar of evangelicalism?" I mean, I'm sure we get this all the time, but... And you have just, you know, 20 seconds in the elevator, and the person says, "So what is an evangelical?" Maybe that's where we should have started, but that's where we'll end. Each give me your 30 second to someone who just meets, they have maybe some basic Christian background. David, what is an evangelical?
Good question. You know, it's hard to reduce it down, isn't it? I think I'd always go back to the Bebington formula and tie it into the early 18th century and talk about, you know, a Christian renewal movement that comes into existence in the 1730s, that in the tradition of Protestant, in the tradition of the Protestant faith, and that seeks a renewal of that in the 1730s.
So Protestant faith seeking renewal, origins in movement the 1730s. Of revival. Yeah, those are all good bullet points. What else would you say with your short elevator ride, Andrew?
If I was in an elevator, I think I would go back to the New Testament language of the good news, the evangel, and say that an evangelical is trying to live out New Testament faith in a contemporary context, in the culture and generation that God's placed them in.
Very good. We can't go, you know, that to say evangelical means good news. Gospel Christians is certainly part of the answer we want to give. Well, thank you both for coming on. I hope we'll have occasion to have you on again. My historians in the bullpen, that's a baseball reference, but you used a cricket reference, which I didn't quite understand. So it's all fair. You have 11 people. Is that right? 11 people come? Okay. So it's just like football of both kinds. Good 11. All right. Andrew and David, thank you. All the Lord's best and blessings on your work, and look forward to these different works. So you got J.C. Ryle. Is that the next thing coming out? And what did you say you're working on? You're editing Whitfield Correspondence?
Whitfield Letters, and then a book on evangelism in Wales in the 20th century.
Ah, very good. Well. And anything else, Andrew, with the J.C. Ryle? What's next?
And after that, it is evangelicalism in the Church of England since the 1960s.
Ah, that would be very, very interesting. Yeah, in both of those. Very good. Well, thank you all for joining us on Life and Books and Everything, a ministry of Clearly Reformed. You can go to clearlyreformed.org for episodes like this and lots of other resources. So thanks for joining us. Until next time, glorify God, enjoy Him forever, and read a good book.